Hello, I'm Dr. Mark Porter and thank you for downloading this edition of Inside Health. I hope you enjoy it. Conflict of interest is dividing doctors. On the one hand, concerned campaigners argue that hidden influences are altering the treatments they use and undermining confidence in the profession, public health services and the expert committees that advise them.
The problem in medicine is that conflicts of interest have got out of control and people who are heavily conflicted are presenting themselves as independent. We have a crisis, in fact, in medicine, and that crisis is a crisis of public trust because conflicts of interest have been allowed to get so out of control.
While at the other extreme, some believe the problem's been overblown and that countermeasures are stifling innovation and harming patient care.
The conflict of interest concern has gone way far. The pendulum has swung to way overblown, and the pendulum stuck.
And just to compound the confusion for the vast majority that lie between these two poles, it's not always obvious when influences are at work, particularly in the convoluted world of healthcare.
If a pharmaceutical company is paying for education, for conferences where talks are being given on their drugs, I think it's very, very easy to be like a sponge and absorb all this information and subconsciously be influenced by it.
Conflicts of interest arise for lots of different reasons, ranging from researchers receiving funding from drug companies to politicians being lobbied by the tobacco and drinks industry. What they have in common is the potential to affect judgment and an individual's or an organisation's impartiality because of a clash between their own self-interests and the interests of others. The world of medicine is tightly regulated to try and reduce the likelihood of such conflicts. But this isn't about a few bad apples who'll do or say anything in exchange for under-the-table favours. It's about a far more subtle group of influences that most researchers, clinicians and policymakers will have all experienced at one time or another, often unwittingly. But who's behind these hidden pressures? How do we respond to them? And what sort of impact might they be having on the health of our nation? That's what we'll be exploring over the next three programmes. Today, researchers, experts and the pharmaceutical industry. Just how big a problem do we face? Well, it depends whom you ask. Ray Moynihan is a senior research fellow at Bond University in Australia.
Currently, we're getting very distorted versions of reality because so many of the sources of information in medicine are so heavily conflicted. Now, the patient loses out, the public loses out, because we lose the independent voices that can give us an honest and open assessment of how good drugs are, how good different treatments are, and what their harms are. We can no longer trust much research because it's been funded by industry. We can't trust many of our leading experts in medicine because they're on the drug company payroll. We can't even trust some of the definitions of disease because of their links with pharmaceutical companies. And sadly, we can't trust a lot of patient groups because of their sponsorship by industry as well.
Ray, you're suggesting that this is a huge problem. That's, I mean, you're using words like much, many, most. Is that really the case?
Conflict of interest is one of the biggest challenges for contemporary medicine.
The conflict of interest concern qualifies as a mania, which means it has no substance, and yet it's gone from strength to strength.
Tom Stossel is the American Cancer Society Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School.
All of the conflict of interest regulation that we do have has slowed innovation. Nothing epitomizes this more than a law that was recently passed as part of the healthcare reform in the United States called the Physician Payments Sunshine Act. What it is that companies must report to the government every payment of $10 to a physician. You know the industry has gotten itself into a low circle of disrespect hell when that happens.
The concern about conflict of interest is not an anti-innovation position. Of course, there is a role for industry academic collaborations, but I think it's the nature of that interaction that we're talking about. And if you actually look at the people who sit in rooms and draw the line between abnormal and normal, people who actually decide whether I've got diabetes type 2, whether my kids have got ADHD, whether my mother's got pre-dementia, the people who decide that are the same people who are literally working for the companies that make the products for those conditions.
So, Ray, what you're saying is that this starts right at the beginning, where diseases are defined, deciding whether someone's ill or not.
Well, that's right. That's the scary thing. Myself and some colleagues did some research last year where we looked at the expert panels which actually define diseases: asthma, hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes, depression, ADHD, 14 common conditions. What we found were two things in particular: that commonly the definitions are widened so that more people are classified as being sick, but secondly, that something like three quarters of the panel members had multiple financial ties to multiple pharmaceutical companies, and those companies were the same companies selling drugs for that particular condition. We can't actually make any claims that it's the conflicts that are causing those members to expand those definitions, but there's definitely the appearance of a conflict. There's a strong smell, and certainly over time, relationships build up.
Ray Moynihan, many of whom's concerns are shared by campaigners here in the UK, like Inside Health's Dr. Margaret McCartney, who's a GP in Glasgow.
What I'm concerned about is a doctor who's also working as a consultant to a pharmaceutical company, or many of them, a doctor who has all his research for his department, or a vast amount of it, paid for by a particular pharmaceutical company, who have a particular agenda to be examining with their research programme. I think it's very hard to know where a conflict of interest starts, but I do know that I feel very uncomfortable with so many panel members for so many different organisations giving advice when they do have other interests. And the use of language, I think, is quite significant. We talk about honoraria, we talk about fees, we talk about, you know, educational meetings, we don't talk about promotional meetings. And a couple of times I've gone to doctors who have made promotional material and I've asked them, are they in the pay of the pharmaceutical company? And they'll say, no, it was an honorarium, I'm not salaried, I don't really have anything to do with them. And I think it provides a little bit of a cloak for doctors to feel a bit better about what they're doing.
Would you have a concern if I was to come up with something I wanted to test? I'd come up with my own trial. I'm an eminent researcher and I go to industry and get funding for that. But it's my team that's setting the agenda.
And this is very much the case that many academics will make. You know, they say they'll get money from industry and industry don't have any ability to influence them at all. Well, that has to be better, you would think. But the problem is still one of institutional or reputational bias. So when you have a whole research institute that's built up on funding from a particular part of industry to try and find a particular outcome, how unbiased is your research going to end up being? Are you going to end up asking the questions that the pharmaceutical industry want to ask, as opposed to the questions that patients would like to ask?
Drug companies fund most of the research into new treatments and often have close ties to the expert groups that interpret that research and decide how those new treatments should be used. So how might that impact on public health?
Today's newsreader is Corrie Caulfield.
A group of leading doctors is claiming that plans to encourage millions more people to take statins to prevent heart attacks and strokes underestimate the risks and the side effects. They accuse NICE of giving too much weight to studies funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Here's our health correspondent Adam Brimelow.
The letter to the chairman of NICE says the draft advice is...
NICE has now confirmed the decision to offer statins to millions more, a change based largely on evidence provided by the Clinical Trial Service Unit, run by Sir Rory Collins, British Heart Foundation Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology at the University of Oxford. So how does he respond to concerns that his unit may be conflicted because of relationships with industry who fund much of their research?
Well, we've always been concerned about this potential issue. So for about 30 years, we've had an explicit policy not to accept honoraria, consultancies, any payments directly or indirectly from industry for any of the work that we do, giving talks and things like that, other than the reimbursement of travel and accommodation to take part in scientific meetings. With respect to the research that we do, sometimes it's possible to get the funding from government or from charity. And in fact, the biggest statin trial we did was largely funded by the Medical Research Council and the British Heart Foundation, but there was funding also from a statin manufacturer, Merck, and from a vitamin manufacturer, Roche, because we tested both treatments. And the contractual agreement we had for that trial and all the trials we do is that we design the study, we run the study, we analyze the data, we interpret it, we publish it, and we, not the companies, hold the database that would allow them to analyze the effects of treatment.
What about personal relationships between you and pharmaceutical industry or anybody else? Do you draw any income from these people?
No.
But if you look at the blogs and the internet and even some of the national press, you know, when they mention your name, there's this sort of, well, he's funded by industry, and he would say that, wouldn't he? I mean, does that not make you cross?
What makes me cross is the effect on patients and the public and their doctors about being misinformed. Your patients are coming into your practice and stopping their statin as a result of this controversy. If that's occurring all over the UK, for higher-risk patients, for example, people who've already had a heart attack or stroke, that could be life-threatening.
So you're confident that there are enough checks and balances in place to avoid conflict of interest?
I'm confident that from the point of view of the work that we do it for good science, for generating reliable evidence, which is unbiased, and that misrepresenting that evidence is not in the public interest.
I signed the letter really because for a number of years I've had serious concerns about the fact that we are giving out statins in particular, but a whole host of other medicines, to well people with evidence that at best shows that you're taking someone who's already at low risk and making them even lower risk.
Claire Gerarda, former chair of the Royal College of GPs, was one of the signatories to the open letter written to NICE.
Mark, of course there's conflict of interest, and I'm not saying this in a duplicitous way. I don't believe there's some malicious reason that the pharmaceutical industry are funding the research and finding their findings. But what I do think is happening is if you put very clever scientists who spend their entire life doing this work, and to be fair, get in hundreds of millions of pounds in research money that funds them and their whole department, of course there's going to be conflicts. And of course, it's important that we look at the research. We're not against research and not against science. But actually, if we're going to be putting 11 million well people on a medicine, potentially for the rest of their life, we must find ways of reducing conflict.
So if all the statin trials had been independently funded, nothing to do with industry, mm-hmm. the statin manufacturers, would you still have written that letter?
Oh, yes. Because actually, I have no doubt, and I know this might sound paradoxical, that the people who did the research did it as best as they could. And very good, very robust people. So if these people had been funded, for example, through the state, so say they had been given a grant with no pharmacological investment at all, I would still be concerned, not because about the robustness of their findings. They can find what they like. It's the translation of those findings that I'm concerned about. And I think when the referee, when NICE do their guidelines, they expect to have the experts around that table who know more than some of the others. What I would say, though, it's important that you don't overpopulate the expert committee with people who have links to the very drugs that actually they're promoting through some route or another.
For me, the real critical test is, are we trusted? If we're not trusted, we might as well go home. And the key to trust is transparency. Even our board meetings are held in public.
Professor David Haslam is chair of the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence.
You can't absolutely exclude people who have ever, ever had any link with any organisation which might have an interest.
Just explain why you can't.
Well, if you want an expert, you go to people who know stuff and people who maybe have spent a lifetime working in a particular area, say hypertension or osteoarthritis or whatever, are likely at some stage of their career to have had some link with an organisation that may have another interest. Now, the key thing for us is to know about that, to declare it absolutely openly at the beginning of any piece of work that we do. We publish potential conflicts of anybody who might be there. And the chairs of all our committees, and ultimately me, have the absolute right and duty to make sure that people are excluded from discussion if it seems that the conflict is going to be prejudicial to us getting the right answer.
I think the scientists, it's important they put their work in the public domain, but I think they should then step away.
And that's because of conflict of interest. We're not talking about funding or money or anything. We're talking about the fact that this is their baby.
They're
invested in it academically.
And it's there in the public domain. Of course they'll be conflicted.
To be very frank, the last person I would rely on to tell me about the benefits of a new drug for high blood pressure would be a doctor who'd been taking money from the manufacturer of that product. I mean, I might go to that person to ask about the technical specifications of the pharmacology, but the last person I would go to find out how well that drug worked, what its harms were, who should take it, would be a specialist who's been receiving money from the manufacturer. You don't have to look further than the recent scandal over the flu drugs to see that there is a real need for more independently funded trials, particularly when that evidence becomes so pertinent for the kind of life or death decisions that are made in the doctor's surgery.
A review of the antiviral drug Tamiflu has cast doubt on its effectiveness and raised questions about whether hundreds of millions of pounds were wasted stockpiling it to combat a flu pandemic.
The scandal centred on concerns that many of the doctors and scientists involved in advising the World Health Organization and governments during the swine flu epidemic in 2009-10 had conflicts of interest that were not always declared. Some had received research grants from companies that made flu vaccines or antiviral drugs like Tamiflu. Some held shares in those companies, while others worked as consultants or advisors to them. Might these conflicts have had an influence on our government's decision to spend close to £500 million stockpiling antiviral drugs that were, in retrospect, not required and probably would not have been that helpful even if they had been? But it wasn't just our government and the WHO who might have been influenced. These same experts were widely cited in the media, to whom the public turned for guidance on what to do. So might those same conflicts have altered public perception of the threat of swine flu too? Kate Mandeville is a public health doctor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and has been researching this very area.
We found that actually academics were extremely influential, more influential than we expected. They were the second most commonly quoted source after ministers of health. But we found that academics who had links to pharmaceutical industries, conflicts of interest, were more likely to talk up the risks of swine flu to the public than those scientists who didn't have any links at all. And we also found that scientists with these links were more likely to promote antiviral drugs like Tamiflu than those scientists just providing general comments.
The simple conclusion is that the people who were sitting on these committees that were linked to the pharmaceutical industry were more likely to sell, if you like, in inverted commas, the importance of vaccines and antivirals to both the public and, one presumes, to the authorities that they're advising as well.
The thing which you don't see is the confounding factor here, which is perhaps those scientists who were most concerned were also the ones more likely to work with industry and more likely to try and prepare the public for an epidemic. But what's important is that the public has just an equal right as the scientific community to know about those potential conflict of interest and judge those comments with those conflict of interest in mind.
But given the checks and balances that are supposed to be in place, do we have convincing evidence that such conflicts significantly alter researchers' findings or conclusions? Inside Health's Margaret McCartney.
We know for a fact that negative trials, trials showing that something doesn't work, are far less likely to be published by the pharmaceutical industry than by independent sources of income. We know that trials go missing. We know that trials which we know are going on don't end up getting reported from the pharmaceutical industry, and that's subject to the big All Trials campaign just now.
But is there any hard evidence that if a trial is funded by a pharmaceutical industry as opposed to somebody like the MRC, the Medical Research Council, that it makes a difference to the outcome?
Well, there shouldn't be. You would think that there shouldn't be. A trial is a trial. But unfortunately, it is the case that, and there have been reviews of this done, several reviews done, looking at what kinds of outcomes are generated from trials depending on their sponsor. You would expect the funder to make no difference over the outcomes of the trials, but they are making a difference in the trials, and that's a fundamental problem.
My name's Gerard Hastings. I am a professor at Stirling and the Open University, and I have a particular interest in how business impacts on public health. And the classic study was in the area of tobacco and the impact of smoke-free legislation on the profitability of pubs and bars and restaurants and so on. And out of something like 100 studies done, 40 showed that it had a harmful effect on the economy of these businesses, and 60 showed it didn't. And lo and behold, the determining factor was that the 40 that found a problem were funded by the tobacco industry.
The other issue is that when a trial has been designed and made by the pharmaceutical industry, we know that those kind of trials contain more potential biases than non-pharmaceutical industry-sponsored trials.
There is an important distinction between researchers who are conducting research that's funded by industry and key opinion leaders who are the experts who speak for industry and who consult with industry. I think that is a very important distinction.
Although they're often one and the same person.
And that's when the conflict does get out of control.
Ray Moynihan. But who are these key opinion leaders? Fiona Godley is editor of the British Medical Journal, which, incidentally, derives significant advertising revenue from drug companies.
I think there's a lot of hidden influence in medicine that is only just beginning to be unpicked. And the kind of things that are signals that someone is a key opinion leader are being on what Americans call speaker bureaus. So these are lists of speakers who will speak on a topic. They may have entered into contracts which specify what they will say, the types of things they will say, that they will speak to the media on behalf of the company. They're often paid over and above what would be a normal rate for a talk. They may put their name to a piece of work which they didn't do, which was written by an employee of the pharmaceutical company or the device company. And what industry is doing, perfectly legitimately often, is piggybacking on that person's credibility.
So what would you say to one of your readers then, who's looking at something that's published in your journal, maybe by one of these key opinion leaders? Are you saying that they should look at that with a degree of cynicism?
Very often the recipient of that information won't know that the person speaking at a meeting has that funding behind them. Sometimes they will know. Some doctors will stand up and say, I'm not influenced because I get money from everyone, as if that makes it okay. It always makes me laugh. I can't think that they could really justify that.
That's what happens a lot at conferences. You hear they flash through that first slide, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And I think you should just get up and walk out if that happens.
My name is Andrew Powery-Smith, and I'm one of the directors of the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry. It is through collaboration between industry and health professionals that has rewritten the story of so many diseases. What we need to do is foster and encourage those relationships under the right ethical framework.
There has been some concern that you have over-fostered the relationships with some leading experts, these so-called key opinion leaders, and effectively it's sort of blurring the boundary between education and marketing.
I think it's particularly important to be clear on what is promotion and what is education. And also, we are increasing dramatically the transparency around the financial relationships between industry and the people that we work with. So from January the 1st, 2015, we'll be collecting the data on all those payments that we make to doctors for things like speaking and consultancy and so on, and then publishing those in 2016 in a publicly single searchable database. It'll be dead easy for people to go on, you look up their own GP or consultant and find out what their relationships are with the pharmaceutical industry from a financial perspective.
And just to put the scale of those payments in perspective, 21,000 UK healthcare professionals received a combined total of £40 million from the pharmaceutical industry in 2012. BBC Panorama recently raised questions about drug companies' influence on key opinion leaders in a documentary that included a hidden camera sequence in a lecture given to doctors by David Nutt, Professor of Neuropsychopharmacology at Imperial College London. The lecture was about nalmefene, a new treatment for addiction, and Professor Nutt was paid to deliver the talk by the company that manufactures the drug. The accusation was all too clear, namely that David Nutt was promoting nalmefene in a good light, because he'd been paid to do so. an accusation that the professor thinks unfair, and one that he vehemently denies. He's a recognised world authority on the pathway in the brain that nalmefene targets. So would the fact that he'd been paid to lecture on his specialist subject really alter what he had to say?
Lectures that are sponsored by drug companies, they either pay me to do the lecture or they put money into my research fund to do the lecture. The rate I'm paid is determined by Imperial College, you know, so they have a set rate for a senior professor like myself. And the companies, through that, support, you know, my research. All my interests are declared, they're on websites, they're also disclosed usually at the beginning of every lecture I give. I mean, that's a standard practice.
And in terms of content, it's your lecture, or is it a lecture that you're being asked to give on behalf of the person who's paying you?
My lectures are my lectures. I mean, there's no way I'm going to give a lecture that someone else has written. I spent 25 years researching this field. Eventually, a company, after many years, has come along and actually taken notice of our research and developed a compound. So, you know, I'm sharing with them this breakthrough which has been built on our foundations, and people think I'm in the company's pocket.
But it's that way around. Yeah. You've been looking at this system for 2.5 decades, and then along comes a company with a drug that works on that system, so they want to get involved with you.
And they say to me, can you explain to the world why we've got this drug? And I say, sure I can, because, you know, look at all this research. And, you know, it's wonderful that they have actually had the confidence to invest in a drug which works on this system. And it's wonderful for me that the hypotheses we generated have been kind of validated by the drug being licensed.
I suppose the concern now might be that here you are, 25 years worth of research, you put something on the map, along comes a pharmaceutical company who've got an interest in it going a particular way. They want to sell their product. Mm. And that might influence the research that you do from now on.
You could think that, but I can assure you it won't.
It's been your hand on the tiller up until now.
Yes.
And I suppose the concern is that it might be two hands on the tiller pointing your research effort in a direction that might benefit the company more. Is there any fear of that?
Well, that's an interesting theoretical position. I mean, by and large, we have to still work extremely hard to get pharmaceutical companies to give us money to do research.
Drug companies physically pay specialists to speak at conferences, to travel to conferences, to consult on marketing strategies. And these are the particularly distorting activities that really need a lot more scrutiny.
So these are essentially educational meetings, but you're saying that many of the speakers that are there, the eminent speakers often, are being paid by the pharmaceutical industry. Does that necessarily mean that it's altering what they have to say?
That's the $64 million question. And of course, many of these experts will argue that they can take the money and they can stay independent.
And we'll be trying to answer that $64 million question next week when we look a little closer to home. So far, we've examined potential conflicts of interest in large organisations, research groups and among key opinion leaders. But how do these conflicts affect the treatment you receive from your GP or specialist, or even the advice offered by health charities and other patient groups? Join me next week to find out. You've been listening to a downloaded edition of Inside Health. If you'd like to hear more, please visit the Inside Health website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.